Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. You guys already know that I talk with guests who are experts in different areas of life about how you can perform better at everything you do as a human being. And one of the things that you probably haven't done enough of in improving your own performance is resting. And today's episode is all about how to fully rest. Everyone's under stress all the time because there's this whole fear thing that's part of our body, our whole hunger, stress, and maybe you have, you know, some kind of cold or something, or maybe you're just worried about the end of the world. It could be any of those things, zombies, apocalypses, chainsaws, whatever. We all have stress all the time, including exercise, including just life, right? Life is stress by its definition. But I think most of us have been under more financial stress and emotional stress and just weird stress in the first half of 2020 than in a long time. It affects you physically, mentally, probably financially, probably socially. So I'm bringing in Greg Wells, PhD, and we're going to talk about health and performance under extreme conditions. I like him because he's a scientist and a physiologist who looks at human limits, makes them understandable, very actionable for you. And he just came out with a new book in March called Rest, Refocus, Recharge, a guide for optimizing your life. And it came out right as lockdowns were getting rolled out everywhere. But isn't it a veteran endurance athlete who is going to teach us on the show today how to slow down so you have energy to speed back up as life gets back on track? Greg, welcome to the show.
Dave, thanks so much for having me here. I really appreciate it. So good to be able to talk to you.
You are the second translational medicine officer that I've had on the show most recently. I had the team from Viome on where we were talking about that. And translational medicine or chief translational science officer is a very new role in the world. And you're one of the few out there. And you do this in Toronto at the Hospital for Sick Children. Do they have a hospital for well children, by the way?
They should. It's one of my goals, actually, that one day I walk into the hospital and it's empty.
There you go.
Kind of cool. Like, it's like my career mission is like, oh, there's no one here. I can leave now.
It's kind of funny. Like, as a name for a hospital, like they don't have hospitals for any other children that who aren't sick that I'm aware of. But anyway, what makes you a translational medicine guy and an endurance athlete? That's just a weird combination, even by the standards of the people who come on the show.
Right. Yeah, it is a bizarre. So I live a balanced life, but it's out at the extremes. So the way that I ended up in both worlds is I ended up doing a PhD in exercise physiology with a respiratory medicine, a respiratory physiology bend to it. So I looked at how breathing and changing breathing affects sports performance in trained sports like rowing, cycling, swimming, running, like where your breathing and movement are linked.
Huge, and so that was
super cool, right? So if you can change your sensitivity to carbon dioxide, you can allow the movement to dictate your performance, not your breathing to dictate the performance. So think rowing, right? You have to breathe in time with the stroke. If it falls out of sync, everything falls apart. Same with swimming. You can't rush to the next breath. You've got to let the technique dictate when you breathe. And so that was all of my PhD. And then as soon as I graduated, I went to Africa for 5 months and rode my bike, and I got back and I couldn't get a job. Funny enough, you can't get a job once you have a PhD. And I ran into someone from the Hospital for Sick Children, Dr. Alan Coates, who ran the exercise lab that tests children with cystic fibrosis, a lung disease. And he's like, oh, you have a respiratory physiology background. Why don't you come and help me run the lab at SickKids? And that launched the medical side of things. So I've always sort of had this high performance sports interest, but then also applied it at the limits for children that are really struggling to be healthy. And then now what I do is I take all the information that we get about research from research and translate it for people to apply in their lives, regardless of whether you're, you know, an elite athlete or whether you're battling illness. Now it's just for everybody. We want everyone to benefit from the knowledge, and that's what we do.
That is, it's fascinating to be able to apply that to kids because breathing and cystic fibrosis are so important. It seems like there's a renaissance in breathing. I started learning about this from doing yoga. I did Art of Living breathing exercises every day for 5 years and met Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. I actually wrote a foreword for his lead trainer's book. And it turns out there's so much that happens there. And holotropic breathing, Stan Grof has come and actually done an event with the Human Performance Institute, the training institute that I started. And I've found that I've reached some very altered states from breathing that are unknown. And last night I had my lips taped closed so I'd breathe through my nose as I was sleeping. But I kind of find, and of course, covering one nostril versus the other. So I've gone pretty deep in biohacking for all that stuff. But I don't feel like there's a definitive guide, like do this kind of breathing to get this result in this circumstance. And even though I'm pretty good at what I do as a biohacker, the guy who kind of created that, I don't necessarily know what breath to choose for what time. Do you? I don't necessarily know what breath to choose for what time. Do you?
So any scientist that tells you that they have a definitive answer to something is probably like lying. Like what we do is we learn as we go, right? We expand our knowledge. Anyway, so like even in my PhD defense, I had two like of the most decorated PhD researchers in, physiology, and they started arguing about breathing, and that wasted 20 minutes of my PhD defense, which was great because they weren't questioning me. They were questioning each other. And I just let it go. But here's an extreme. Like the medulla in the brain, which is where we control breathing, is actually linked to the center of the brain that is also involved in stress regulation. So if you take long, slow, deep breaths, you know that you can calm the body down. We know that. You can actually feel it. If anyone just takes three deep breaths right now, you're going to relax. The other end of that spectrum is if you want to activate the nervous system, you can exhale really hard. That's why tennis players, for example, scream and exhale when they hit the ball. That activates the nervous system and increases your stress and your explosiveness. In between those two extremes are, all the other things that we can do with our breathing. I too have entered into some very strange altered states through breathing, where I felt like I was on LSD, and I've never done LSD, so I don't know, but I assume that's what it feels like, which is pretty wild. And I've also done the whole Wim Hof method where you use breathing to heat yourself up when you're immersed in.
Been on the show. Yeah. That stuff's crazy. You really go places, right?
Yeah. Like I spent 20 minutes in Lake Geneva in Zurich in December in a snowstorm with Ian LePatin from Spiritual Gangster. We were just like hanging out. Like I could stay there indefinitely once I learned how to do that breathing pattern. So when we use breathing, breathing for many people is just unconscious, and that's a good thing because it's regulated and you breathe and you stay alive. But you can also use breathing to improve your performance. You can use breathing to perform better in sports. You can use breathing to perform better when you're doing public speaking. You can use breathing to calm yourself down so that you respond to people instead of react to them when they say something that you disagree with. So it's excellent in like meetings and stuff like that. Like it's a very, very powerful tool for us. And it's probably one that we just think that we take for granted. So I think it's definitely something you can explore and learn a lot from.
What's the best breath?
If I need to relax, and obviously it's slow, deep breathing. If I'm trying to fall asleep, it's slow, deep breathing. If I'm trying to meditate, it's bringing my mind into the moment so I can focus on my breath. If I'm trying to get psyched up for sports, maybe I want to breathe a little bit harder to energize myself. If I want to deliver a line better when I'm speaking, maybe slow down your speaking so that you can actually inhale as you deliver that sentence like I just did there. There's no one best breath. It's using breath to do what you need to do at a higher level.
No one best breath. All right. My favorite breath right before I go to sleep is called the Ujjayi breath. And I've written about that in a couple of the books. And I've rarely take more than 3 minutes to go to sleep. I used to take a lot longer. It's not because I'm exhausted. It's because I know how to go to sleep. But if it takes more than 3 minutes or there's anything slowing me down, I feel like if I do maybe 5 Ujjayi breaths, I wake up the next morning. Is there a more powerful sleep-inducing breath that you know of?
I don't know of a more powerful sleep-inducing breath than Ujjayi breathing, which I'm learning about as I'm getting back into yoga, as I'm getting a little bit older and really starting to dig into that. Getting out of, hardcore endurance sports and sort of just using yoga and breathing to dissipate tension throughout the body. What I've been trying to do with regards to that practice around falling asleep is using breathing in conjunction with settling of the mind and bringing the mind back into the moment, actually letting the mind relax and turn off, which is the hardest thing for me. And when I am able to bring my attention into the moment and shut off my mind in conjunction with that breathing technique, then I just feel so good. And that's what creates the altered states. That's what enables you to drop into that deep sleep so quickly, to recover and regenerate faster. We know that deep sleep's so important, right? So getting into that state faster is better. So I've just been playing with it in that mind body connection. And that's where, and I've been trying to teach my 10-year-old daughter, because she struggles with sleep, and she absolutely loves it. So you can even teach this to kids. Like, they pick up on it really quick, which is kind of neat.
They really do. My daughter was having a terrible time at exactly 10 going to sleep. And I ended up giving her the audio app for Dr. Barry Morguelan, who's a master of Chinese energy medicine, who's been on the show a couple times and a dear friend. And one of 12 living grandmasters of this esoteric Chinese thing. So you think, why would my daughter listen to this? And it's because every one of these 15, 20 minute things is breathing with a story. And it's not meant for kids, it's meant for adults. But the story is, you know, your energy is going to the middle of the earth. It's going to the heavens. And now you're riding on a carpet and the stuff. And you go into weird altered states. I feel electricity zipping out of my body from it. It's very powerful stuff. She, of her own accord, she said after the first week, I said, do you want to do the Dr. Barry exercises again? And she said, you don't have to ask me anymore, Daddy. I'm going to do these every night. I decided, I promised myself I'll do them for the whole month. Okay, this is a 10-year-old without any encouragement. And at the end of the month, I said, what do you think? And she said, I promised myself I'm going to do them every day for a year. And she did it.
That's
without
impressive.
Any encouragement, no rewards, nothing other than I like breathing when I go to sleep, because now I can go to sleep. And there's, you know, something like 50 or 60 different ones. She learned all the different little ones. And I was blown away. But that's what breathing does for kids when they finally learn. But so I love it you're doing that. I'm teaching my son right now. We're doing Tai Chi in the morning. He's 10 now.
Yep.
And it's all about the breath, right?
Totally. And imagine what we're going to teach them in terms of like emotional regulation, right? And understanding that you can actually take control of how you feel.
Okay.
And as they progress through those teenage years, 12, 13, 14, 15, when emotions are all over the place and everything is so reactive, that they can understand that they can actually control how they feel. Hopefully that carries through their entire lives and puts them in a very different place when they're adults, right? Because then we're all end up with this ability to control our emotions, to put ourselves in the right state we need to be in to do what we want to do at the highest possible level. It's so powerful and so cool. I love it that you're starting so young with that, with your daughter and son. That's great.
But you also, as a respiratory guy and just doing medicine and all, you're looking at feedback systems. Like, you almost certainly using capnometers. You're measuring CO2 that's coming out of people. And I have a capnometer behind me for feedback. And most people listening even to this show, you probably haven't heard me say that word before, but yeah, you can actually learn to change your CO2 and oxygen ratios by looking at them, just like almost anything else. But when you provide that kind of feedback to kids, something interesting happens. I've met probably 4 or 5 adults, you know, people, you know, over 40, who are just unusually tuned in. They're people who are doing good things in their life. They're unusually happy. They're making a mark in the world. And we sit down at dinner or whatever, and you're just like, well, okay, this person has a spark. And they'll just mention, you know, Dave, you're into that biofeedback. When I was a kid, my mom or my dad worked at this lab, and I did some biofeedback when I was 8, when I was 10, when I was 12. And, you know, I never thought about it, but I think it made a big difference. So this stood out to me as just massive outliers. The people are just noteworthy. And it's, oh yeah, I did this when I was a kid. So I don't know, Greg, I think you're doing the right thing.
You know, it's interesting. Like, that's why I love, you know, wearable tech. I've got an Apple Watch on, I've got an Oura Ring on, as you do. And I think the data that we're getting on ourselves is so fascinating. Yeah. And I don't love having electrical devices on my body per se, but I do like wearing this ring, what, like for a week, a month, just to sort of check in on how we're doing, so I can understand my deep sleep, my REM sleep, my breathing rate when I'm sleeping, my body temperature, which I've been tracking very carefully in this COVID-19 era, because we know that, you know, plus 0.5 degrees seems to predict an illness a few days before you get it. And I think that when we have this information about our heart rate, about our heart rate variability, about our respiratory rate, about our CO2 levels, that it gives us great information. And I think that the more we understand our body, the more that we can take control of our body. It's not just this thing that we're occupying for a period of time. It's something that we can adapt and that we can change and that we can help grow and that we can make better. And with that feedback, with that information, that's how we course correct. And it's a feedback system, just like you said. And the interplay between feed forward from the brain and feedback from the physiology is basically you know, that's human physiology. That's that entire field of study. And there's just, it's amazing that we all now have access to laboratory quality data using this, these wearable devices that are exponentially improving every single day. It's so cool.
It is cool. They're not helping though with something you mentioned earlier. And I want to ask you about this correlation. So you are a super high performance athlete. You did the world record setting 8,000 mile cycling expeditions across Africa, Ironman Canada. So you're kind of at the upper tier there, and you work with super high performing Olympic world champion athletes and all that. I find that people who are attracted to intense endurance sports are quite often the people who have the hardest time turning off the voice in their head. Do you think you were attracted to those sports because you had a meaner, louder voice in your head than average, or because you're ADHD, or is there something else going on there? Were you self-medicating with exercise?
We could go really deep into that. So this pandemic has served as a time when I've actually been asking myself those questions, Dave. I've had a lot of time to think about, like, why do I do that stuff? Like, I was a competitive swimmer growing up, so I loved swimming and I just got quite good at it. And I ended up at sort of, all my friends made the Olympics. I didn't, that kind of level. I ended up commentating Olympics, which was amazing and super fun. I think I had more fun than they did, but, and then subsequent to that, after my PhD, you know, loving cycling and having been to Africa and loving Africa, I heard about the Tour d'Afrique bike race. So I went and did that. And that was more of an expedition and a life experience. The choice to go do Ironmans a few times and a couple of marathons and climbing Chimborazo volcano and going to South America with my friend Ray Zahab and running from the Pacific to the Atlantic, or he did it, he ran and I did a lot of the physiology. That what I found there is that when I am doing ultra endurance sports and I get to that point where I am tired, I'm exhausted, I'm in a lot of pain, that is one of the only times when my mind actually shuts off. And so I love it because I actually find that it's meditative and it's a chance for me to, you know, relax my mind. Subsequently, I've been doing a lot of work around inner engineering and following the program from Sadhguru around learning to calm my mind, not through exercise, but through breathing, through attentional control. And that's where the deep discoveries are being made about tension, about you know, all of the true insights into how you actually achieve the state of being in the present moment, of being happy, of experiencing pure joy that all of us are capable of experiencing at any given instant. So it's been quite the evolution going from mind to body, discovering the emotions, and landing in a very, very interesting place. So, but you're absolutely right. Like, you hit it right on. I was absolutely self-medicating with ultra endurance work, and I still love it. I still like to do it, but it's different now. It's a choice. Whereas, it's a choice and it's a process in conjunction with the mental training that's going along with it. I think it's a lot more powerful now than it was before.
The reason I'm asking is because even though I was 300 pounds, I was also into cycling in a big way. You know, Dave Scott was one of my heroes when I was 12 or something like this. Long time people recognize him as, you know, the Ironman guru of whatever, the 80s. And I was the only way I could relax. You know, if you get going fast enough on a mountain bike, if you don't just stop thinking, you'll hit a rock and die. So you stop thinking. And when you're exhausted and you're pushing everything, there's a state, right? And since then, I've done so much neurofeedback and breathing exercises. And I'm also a high altitude mountaineering kind of guy. I've actually climbed in Ecuador. And I also found there was peace from that, the exhaustion, a little bit of hypoxia, same thing in Tibet. And like, you just go to these places and they're beautiful, but they're kind of expensive and kind of risky. And certainly time-wise, not that efficient, but also worthy. And so I've kind of gone through that over time, but I did recognize it. Like, I had a family member come and visit from Europe, and I'm in Canada. I'm near, actually also up in Canada. I'm in BC, and it's during the rainy season, and she couldn't go exercise for a few days. And this is someone who runs, you know, 5 miles a day. And it's like, it's too wet. I'm, and you could literally see like a junkie, right? Not right. In a bad way. But you know, just like crawling out of their skin, before finally it doesn't matter. I'm just going to get soaked and be really cold and, you know, fall on the ice or whatever. I'm out. And, that means to me that there is some kind of an addiction or some self-medication.
Well, it is an addiction because it's endorphins. Your brain produces the same actual chemicals that you can take exogenously through cocaine or morphine or whatever else every time that you exercise. So there is absolutely no question that it is addictive. There are a number of, but we know so many benefits from exercise, and whether it's yoga or it's running, or if it's, strength training, there's benefits and they're all different and they all do wonderful things for us. I believe that, and this is hard for me to say as an extreme athlete, is like, I believe that anything in the extreme is probably not good for us. We know that, you know, this is like that's probably the hardest thing I've ever said in public in my life. But anyway, we know for in the immune system, for example, right now that there's a J-shaped relationship between exercise and immune health. And if you do no exercise, your immune health is worse. You're more at risk of respiratory infections. We know that a moderate level of exercise actually improves your resistance to illness. 75% fewer colds and flus for people who exercise on a daily basis. 24 to 40% lower risk of cancer for people who walk every day. But then at the extreme levels, we know that if you're exercising to the point of exhaustion consistently over time, that that is far worse than not exercising at all for your risk for immunity. So what we need to find for each of us is this moderate level where we're healthy, we're getting fitter, we're getting stronger, we're getting more mobile without putting that excessive stress and strain on all of us. And now that I think back about it too, the evolution in sports that happened from training in the 80s and 90s when I was a young athlete coming up to being a physiologist in the 1990s and the 2000s was that we went from high volume training, just whoever survived the training was the one who made the Olympic team. Like if you didn't get injured and sick, you win. Congratulations. But now it's very different. It's actually like you're trying to break a world record consistently in practice. And doing that through massage therapy, through amazing food, through recovery regeneration techniques, through cold, through heat, and all of these other modalities that enable you to get actually radically improve your health as you are training. It's a longer process. And the benefit is like we're seeing careers now going into their, people are now competing at a high level into their 40s. People are breaking world records over decades, not just over a 3-year period. So I think it's a much healthier approach when we do it this way that you and I are talking about, where we incorporate these other factors, these like rest, recover, regenerate, all these sorts of things into our lives. And it's been a huge adaptation for me, you know, coming out of us as a young athlete in the 80s and 90s into ultra endurance sports and these, you know, long expeditions into a place where I'm trying to just be healthy and be a great role model for my kids that are coming up and to lead people into a new place now that we have this information so we can all as a world be healthy and high performing and reach our potential.
It reminds me of the Bryan brothers. I've been on tennis, two brothers who play tennis doubles, world champions, playing way longer than they're supposed to and winning. And then we see the same thing. Nick Foles has been on the show and we've become friends. And you know, he's okay, how do I put as much recovery tech wherever I'm going to be as I possibly can so that I can continue doing what I love to do? And it seems like it's working. And even Mark Sisson, who's been on the show several times, another friend, a former Ironman athlete and ultra endurance, you know, really a tough guy who just wrote a book about, oh, chronic cardio is bad for you. I was doing it wrong and it made me older than it probably needed to. And he's completely changed how he trains to be less intense and getting more results. So what you're saying makes sense. So this thing has happened, but it maybe isn't apparent to people who just, you know, pick up a magazine or they're still kind of stuck in this mindset. I'm just going to grind it out. When grinding it out probably wears some things away. Now, what in your mind is the best way other than breathing, obviously, unless that is your answer, to undo the grind? So we're all stressed right now. So what's the recovery tech that's most recovery oriented?
We've gone through this global stress response, fight or flight, like literally every single person on the planet's been in fight or flight for about 3 months. And that's this global pandemic. It's the Black Lives Matter revolution, which is wonderful to see finally getting some traction and everyone's waking up to that necessity for us to combat and become and combat systematic racism and be anti-race. Like we've had a lot go on. And I think that the way that we can all, you know, recover and regenerate and get re-energized to make the world a better place. Like, I don't want us going back to normal. I want us to reimagine the future. And if you're talking about like recovery tech, I think the number one thing we can all do, believe it or not, is so simple. It's just sleep. I think that if we're sleeping so well, it's so boring. It's probably not the tactic that you were looking for. But I think that sleep is a very powerful tool for all of us. I think I'm super fascinated also by the research that's coming out recently on the effect of music, especially on mental health. We know that the regions of the brain that are downregulated by depression are upregulated by music. So I'm fascinated by the effect of music on the brain. In terms of recovery from long-term aerobic oxidative exercise, I'm also fascinated by antioxidants and anti-inflammatory eating. I think that's a fascinating approach for all of us to consider right now. And also then just balancing exercise. We know that if we want to be healthy, we can do some cardio. It's totally fine. But if you mix that in with some strength development, then you get both AMP kinase, which lengthens your lifespan, and you optimize mTOR, which optimizes your health span. And so when we mix and match exercise, I think we're in a better place than just doing one thing. So I think those are just a few things to get people started and ideas like how to recover, regenerate, but there's lots that we can do.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
So your whole book, Rest, Refocus, Recharge, and I asked you what you could do. And number one thing you came up with was sleep. Okay, so I'm in agreement with you. But what would you do to optimize sleep during the pandemic or as people are emerging from it?
So the number one thing we did as a family was we stopped using a morning alarm, and it's been an absolute game changer. We use a bedtime alarm, but not a morning alarm. We wake up when we wake up, and that's been a really, it's just a wild thing. And initially, when I first started, I was sleeping so much. I don't think I had any idea how tired I was because I'm doing a lot of public speaking, flying all over the world. I was getting ready to launch my book right into a pandemic when they shut every bookstore in the world. But anyway, so we now don't use morning alarms, and I started sleeping a lot. I'm actually back down where I'm waking up pretty naturally between 5 and 6 every day. So I get up and I head out to the beach and work out. My daughter though, she's 10 years old, 11, she's sleeping so much, and she's grown like 2 inches since the pandemic hit. Adam is sort of like me. He's a bit of an early riser. He's 5. And Judith's a bit more variable because she's starting to get back into running now after 2 years of being injured. And so she's training a bit harder, so sleeping in a little bit more to adapt to that. So we just stopped using the morning alarm and I now want to go to bed early enough that I can wake up naturally to get done what I need to do and hit my meetings and those sorts of things without needing an alarm. So I do set an alarm, but it's the last possible second where it can be set and not get fired. So let's say I have a 9 a.m. meeting, I'll set it for 8:30, knowing full well that I'm probably going to get up between 5 and 6. But you know, if I happen to need that extra 3 hours and my body needs it, it'll get it. And that's been the biggest change we've made. It's been so powerful for us.
Thank you for mentioning the effect on kids of just getting enough sleep during the pandemic. So that's something most parents, most people listening, you haven't done a gratitude exercise for. My kids just got 3 months of quality sleep that they would have otherwise never had. That's kind of legit.
It's really interesting. And also, so as you know, athletes around the world have been blocked from training basically for the last few months, and the Olympics got canceled and then moved. I was chatting to Ben Titley, who's the head coach for the Canadian swim team. He's got a group of athletes coming back in, and there's a group of older athletes and a group of younger athletes. He said the really interesting thing that's happened is that since they've come back, he's noticed that the younger ones suddenly all grew. They're all totally rested. They've been sleeping. He said, this is this weird, unusual thing that I never could have programmed, because swimmers get up, they train twice a day. You're in the pool by 5:30, 6 o'clock. That's been wiped out. And so there's all these really weird positive adaptations that have happened. And, you know, not to minimize the fact that people are dying and have died and are still sick. But I think that there's definitely something that we can take out of this in terms of, like, we're not commuting in the morning. We've got this time. And let's reimagine how we want to feel in the future. Do we want to fill our lives back up with all of these activities and all this busyness? Or do we want to be really intentional about health first, happiness first, joy first, connection first, and then pick and choose the things to drop into our lives, actually make our lives better with intention instead of compulsion? And I think that there was a lot of compulsion and burnout happening right before the pandemic hit that I think we can avoid if we're careful about it as we emerge from the pandemic and get back to a more hopefully open life around the world. So just I'm echoing everything that you're saying there. Couldn't agree with you more. I think that there is some really interesting research that was published a while ago that showed that happiness, there's a correlation between happiness and financial stability up to about $75,000 a year, yes. Beyond which there is no further correlation. And you and I both know very wealthy people who are miserable. So I think that I fully recognize that if you have lost your job, if you are economically struggling right now, further to take it another step, if you're confined at home with an abusive partner or parent, like that also a nightmare that we are seeing, certainly in a number of places in Toronto, according to some friends of mine who are police officers. So like, there's a lot of hardship that's come through this. And so if that's the case, then we're not at a point where we can talk about health and well-being and joy and happiness. We're just simply trying to survive. And I believe that our responsibility, if you're listening to this, is to do the very best you can at what you're great at. Therefore, if you do that, it's quite likely that you're going to generate some sort of economic benefit. So if I do what I'm great at, if I go out and I do public speaking and books, like that generates work for lots of people around. And one of the things I'm most proud of in the companies that I've run, we've laid nobody off. So that's like my biggest accomplishment, I think, in this pandemic, is we have not actually laid anyone off. It's been super hard, but we've gotten through it and we're going to come out better. It also forces a pivot. And the companies that have been able to pivot very rapidly into digital have set themselves up, I believe, for a better future, which ultimately will lead to more. So I believe that we're sort of like in 2008, there's a number of things that happened that led to some exponential growth for certain organizations. I think we're very much going to see that as well. We just need to get through this together, support each other like crazy, and as a community, you know, do what we need to do to get through this time, have food on the table, create the jobs again, get back to taking care of keeping everyone safe, and that way we can open up as fast as possible to get our economy going again, hoping that the new economy will be different, will be better, will be safer, and we will be able to craft a better future together where people are mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually in a better place.
It's definitely a time of rebuilding, and I'm with you there. And I know that it's possible because I've read, you know, the stages and, you know, done some very deep spiritual work and all that. It's possible for, and I've met sadhus, you know, on the slopes of mountains in the middle of nowhere in Nepal, who literally don't have any possessions but a bowl where people put donations or food. And they actually, they're in very altered states, but they appear to be happy. And when I first saw this, I was, you know, a younger man, and it was a little bit disturbing. Like, I was like, what gives them the right to be happy when they have nothing? It was almost a sense of injustice. Like, you know, they could clearly have something, but the fact they chose not to was almost an affront to my little ego at the time. And now, though, I know it's possible, but I don't know how to guide someone who's really financially there, other than guide them to be, you know, in a more satisfied or less stressed state anyway, other than what you've talked about, breathing. So breathing is free. You know, cold showers are free. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the very basic recovery technologies, it seems like that if you have no time at all, it seems like you should follow what Winston Churchill used to do. During World War II, he would take a nap every afternoon, mm-hmm. right? And he would like put on his pajamas and have this whole ritual and take an hour-long nap. And people say, how dare you have a nap in the middle of a war being on? And he looked back at them, and I'm paraphrasing, and said something like, do you think I could do this if I didn't take a nap every day? So if you're highly stressed and you're really worried, doing a little bit more to calm down and recover, even though, yeah, things are actually, when you look at the facts, they're rough right now, But to take the free stuff that makes you feel more powerful, more gratitude, more hope is probably more nourishing and makes you more resilient than not. But I haven't lived through it. Does that seem like good advice?
It's great advice. And I think there's some neurophysiology to back that up. If we take some time to decompress, if we go for the walk, if we sit in the park, if we, you know, get in the cold shower, if we just sit on, you know, and meditate or read a great fiction book, what happens, I've discovered recently in studying the brain a little bit more, is that right now you and I are both in beta brainwave mode. We're hustling, we're concentrating, we're figuring things out as we move through this conversation, and beta brainwaves at a certain frequency. When we relax and slow down and calm our brains down, the brainwaves actually slow in frequency. They literally slow down. If you put electrodes all over the brain, you would see the electrical activity in the brain decrease. If it decreases a little bit, you end up in alpha brainwaves. That's when we can be strategic. That's when we can reflect. That's when we can learn. It's a very different, you can't actually learn. You can't think strategically. You can't reflect. If you're in hustle, 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 go, 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 we have to slow down. If you slow down even further into theta, which is when you're meditating or you're standing in the shower with water going off of your head, or you're driving long distances and daydreaming, which you shouldn't do, but it happens. And that's when you get the eureka moments, the new insights. That theta brainwave state where the brain is super relaxed is when we're creative. It's when we problem solve, and it's when we have agile thinking, when you come up with new solutions to problems. And so I think that it's almost counterintuitive that by doing less, it opens us up to actually being able to do more. And now that we're sort of emerging from this, one of the things I really want to do this summer is to give myself a lot of permission just to have the space to sit and think, or the space to sit and contemplate, the space to sit and reflect, to make sure that the future that we're crafting is different and or better than the one in the past. So that there's a lot of neurophysiology to back up the idea of just simply, like, if you are super stressed, the thing that you probably want to do the least is to slow down and just go for an easy walk somewhere, because you think you just have to keep going to push to get to the next thing. When in fact, the solution, the insight, the eureka moment, the opportunity might be lying somewhere else. And you can't see that when you're in stress. We can only see those opportunities when we slow down.
You talk about some brainwave states that made me really happy in your book. You talk about gamma. In fact, and you have steps in your book, and you talk about embracing the extraordinary. And you talk about shifting into gamma brainwaves for flow states. Most people don't think gamma is trainable. I will tell you for a fact it is, because we're doing that. What is your perspective on gamma brainwaves, particularly, and all the other associated stuff that happens in what you call extraordinary in your book? Just walk me through that.
Yeah. So as an athlete, you're trained to get in the zone so that you're non-judgmental. You act, think, feel to have the best possible performance that you can. And we know that that's a trainable state. For the vast majority of people, we have random experiences with it, but we know that you can actually learn how to do it. We teach it through act, think, feel, which is mind, body, emotional state that you can replicate once you know it's there. You can use biofeedback to get to that state as well, which is wonderful. But gamma is a new one that's been explored recently in the scientific community. And it's when the entire brain works together at the same time, and it goes beyond flow. It gets into peak experience. And peak experience you can think of as a flow state with meaning. So let's say that you are delivering a presentation and you are in flow, but the meaning just connects with the audience and you can feel yourself changing lives, or you're staring into the eyes of a loved one and you know that connected moment is altering the course of both of your lives. Like that's flow plus meaning, which is peak experience. And it's in those states where gamma brainwaves are produced, also in deep meditation and a few other states, but this is a bit more accessible to us in that it's moments that we can all identify with. The moment when you're with your children and they're playing and, you know, you see them, you're fully focused on them, and you can see them, you know, exploring and experiencing the world, which makes you feel absolutely spectacular as well. And a moment that I really feel like I experienced that almost to an extreme level was climbing Chimborazo in Ecuador. It's a volcano, and we were climbing all night long, and snowstorm, and super dangerous, and hypoxic, and like really stressed. But then at one point, as we got high enough, we broke through the clouds, and so the snow stopped, and we were hundreds of kilometers away from a city or town, so it was pitch black, and the sky opened up above us, and I've never seen that many stars because you're at like 19,500 feet.
Yeah.
I've got all of this. I've got the white clouds beneath me, and I look up, and all that I can see is the snow-capped peak and like the full-on stars. And I remember saying, holy and everyone in the group stopped, and everyone just looked up. And there was this moment of silence as we realized that we were the closest humans to the stars, because Chimborazo is the furthest point from the center of the Earth, because the Earth's a bulge right. at the equator. So it's 2K higher than Everest, 2 kilometers higher than Everest, not for sea level, but in terms of distance and closeness to the stars, other than the space station, the astronauts. So we had this moment of realization and this moment of experience. And that was just like, I could feel everything. I felt my entire life. I knew that everything that I'd done had led up to this moment. I knew that it was going to transform what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. So this is the zone plus peak experience. And that was pretty magical. So I've become really interested in peak experience and gamma states and happiness and moments of joy that we can accept, that we can access and wow. try to create. So yeah, that's a pretty interesting state. I'm pretty fascinated by it.
Greg, I think that ought to be your next book. What though, if someone doesn't have access to tech, they don't have access to mountaintops right now. By the way, if you do have access to mountaintops, people who live at high altitude tend to not die of coronavirus. In fact, they tend to not get it almost at all. There's really interesting research about that. It has to do with, I think, hemoglobin and the way our cell receptors work. Mm. Anyway, assuming you have access to either one of those and we want to experience more theta, that really deep relaxation, or we want to experience more gamma, do you have techniques to turn that on?
So let's say you want to get into alpha, which is the reflective strategic thinking. That's just getting yourself into a location where you can read in journal. Like those are two really powerful ways of, I think journaling is probably the best way of getting into alpha because you're just reflective, you're thinking, but you're still awake. Theta, you just need to get somewhere where you can stare off into the distance. Mm-hmm. That's just get into a park. If you can find a beach and just stare at the waves, if you can go for a walk, that works wonders. If you can do what you love to do, so that's art, music, sports, like riding your bike will often trigger it. Paddling does it for me quite often. I'm into paddleboarding right now, and I drop into that state easily. And then gamma is associated with meaning. So it requires us to think a little bit about what matters to us in our lives. For some people, that's their work. For some people, it's their hobby. For some people, it's their families, whatever it is. Okay. And then create those magic moments. And the magic moments really just require you to be there and let it happen. So let's say you're playing with the kids in the park. You're not on your phone. You're not checking your email. You're with your kids playing in the park. If you're having dinner with your family, the devices are away and you're allowing the conversation to flow with no judgment and no, you know, push-pull. It's just simply experience. And when we have these magical experiences in combination with what we care about in our lives, then I think that you'll discover that peak experience begins to pop up into your life more and more and more. It's one of the reasons why I'm trying to, you know, as we come out of this coronavirus era, I'm trying to really schedule and build expeditions into my work because I love them. I love doing it. I love going to these places. You know, at Christmas, we went to Galapagos with my family, and my daughter Ingrid got into the water and we were swimming with sharks. Like swimming with a 10-year-old with sharks is pretty profound. You know, she had a face-to-face moment with a sea lion in the ocean. Pretty cool.
So good.
Right. So like we just, and again, doesn't need to be that. It can be sitting in your local park, watching your kids play soccer. You know, I've been to 50 countries around the world, and it's not necessarily money that you need to make these happen. You don't need to go to the mountaintops. Like I've seen incredible things in India. I've seen incredible things in Africa. I've seen incredible things in Central America with people doing what they love to do with the people that they love to do it with, or the people that they just love. And out of that, just these sparks of magic pop into your life. And that's, I think, something we all need more of these days.
It's beautiful. I want to know about high altitude hacking. I have done a lot of this myself to be able to survive and thrive in a hypoxic environment. What do you do when you go to these high things? You're an expert in breathing, the respiratory side of things, and an expert in high altitude stuff and exercise and endurance and all this. So you are one of those rare people who's going to know more than me.
Got it.
Teach me.
So I think we did Chimborazo really well. We put two people on the summit. Jillian White, Sarah Thompson, both of whom did research with me. Another doctor from SickKids came along and a bunch of his friends from Germany. We got close, but did not get to the summit. I turned around at around 6,000 meters because I thought I was 50-50 as to whether or not I was going to get off the mountain, and I had a family. So I made that conscious decision. Which I know sometimes people don't make. But we did a really good job this time in that we had a very good base camp at around 14,000 feet. The summit was like 21,000. So we set ourselves up at a really good base camp. We did a lot of exercise at moderate, like 14 to 16,000 feet, like just long walks in the 2 weeks that we were there. We found that really helped us to acclimatize quickly. Hydration is one of the hardest things to do because you're constantly blowing off water. And so we worked a lot on drinking enough fluid and just continuously doing that. The challenge when you're up at altitude is you hyperventilate because your oxygen levels drop, which makes you hypersensitive to CO2. Then you blow off all your CO2, then you underventilate. And so you get these wicked headaches. And so we took acetazolamide this time, which helps to control bicarbonate levels in your blood. And we took a lot of gear with us. So we monitored our hemoglobin and hematocrit levels every single day, a few times a day, actually, until we were all at 50 to 55%. Red blood cells, which is a lot, like 50%, you're basically out of the Olympics, right? So like we're at the limits of what we were capable of. And we all just naturally adapted to that. But the really interesting moment of the entire trip was we did a training climb at to 5,800 meters. 66,000 was sort of the, and 61 was the peak. So there's some thresholds there, but we got to 5,800 meters one day on the training session. And we were sitting on the mountain having a bite to eat. And all of a sudden it got dark. So these clouds came over the back of the mountain and it went from warm to below freezing within about 3 minutes. And the wind picked up and the pressure dropped. And so we went from oxygen saturations of 85%, which is low, but fine, to 65 or lower, which is dangerous, like legit dangerous.
That's bad news.
Yeah, like you're hospitalized. If it were anywhere near a hospital, we would have been thrown into the hospital. And we all looked at each other, we got to get off this mountain. And so, but I got tunnel vision. So I could only see literally like, if I held my arm out at full arm's length, I could only see the space where my hand was. And so I stared at the boots of the person in front of me and followed them for 3 or 4 hours down the mountain as we all got ourselves off and, you know, someone was puking. Like it was bad, like really bad.
Yeah, you're lucky you made it.
Yeah, it was not a good scenario. Anyway, so what was really fascinating about that experience though, was that the day after and the day after that, our bodies hyper adapted. So our hemoglobin levels shot up and we were tracking a bunch of other measures as well. And we had an amazing device called an iStat with us. We were looking at, you know, all these different...
I'm so jealous. You got to climb with all that stuff. That's so cool. All
right. It was so cool. We had so much gear with us. It was so fun. Lactate as well. Because you produce lactate when you're in altitude as well. So we'd be like hammering, like going so hard and take our blood lactates and it'd be like 1.8, which is lower than resting at sea level. Because like you just simply don't produce lactate when you're in sort of this weird paradox once you get up there. But anyway, that state where we were in, where we were really low oxygen for a few hours, I think triggered our bodies to hypercompensate with this massive production of EPO, erythropoietin, which stimulated the growth of lots of red blood cells and dumped a whole ton of new red blood cells into our systems, which 3 days later, when we went for the summit, we could feel it was way easier. I mean, we went harder to climb, but like clearly we had physiologically adapted at that point in time. So we're learning, we're getting better at it. And, Diamox definitely helped and water definitely helped. And some of these training days, which were so brutal, definitely helped as well.
That is fascinating. One more thing before we go. And it's something that I did years ago as I rented a capnometer to be able to learn how to control my exhaust gas. And I don't know that it did huge amounts for me, but it probably made me more aware of my breathing. And I bought one a couple of years ago. I haven't really played with it too much since. It's sitting on a desk behind me amongst a stack of other biofeedback toys I haven't had time to deal with. And I know at 40 years in, we use HRV and we actually show people this respiratory rate will create the best heart rate variability for you. It's part of our first day training so people can have the right breathing while they're doing alpha and other types of brain states and reset mode stuff. what is the ideal respiration rate for people? Should people consider finding a respiratory therapist to do a capnometer and figure out what breathing works for them? Like, just walk me through exhaust gas biofeedback, because most people, sure, even in biohacking, this is cutting edge stuff.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. So this is what I've been playing with for a long time. This is great. No one ever wants to talk to me about this stuff. It's so great. So the easiest way to think of it is that we have chemoreceptors in our aorta. So the blood leaves the heart, and in the aortic arch, there are sensors called chemoreceptors that taste the blood for hydrogen ions and carbon dioxide. So how acidic is the blood? Basically, it wants to know that. So the more CO2 you have, the more waste gas that you have, the more that these chemoreceptors send information to the brain to make you breathe harder. You have a second set of chemoreceptors on the inside of your, on your brain that taste the cerebral spinal fluid. That's sort of like the last line of defense. So if your cerebral spinal fluid is getting acidic, then it's like, you got to breathe a lot. Okay. So then what happens is you breathe harder, the nerve, it's a feedback to feed forward loop that increases the drive to breathe. So when you breathe harder, you then blow off all the CO2 and you bring yourself back down to your set point. So for most people, the set point is 38 to 40 millimeters of mercury of carbon dioxide pressure in your blood. If it goes below that, you stop breathing or you breathe less. So if you hyperventilate, for example, and blow off all your CO2, you can sit there for 5 minutes and not breathe, mm-hmm, because the CO2 will slowly build back up. Be careful your oxygen doesn't drop, because then you pass out and die. So it's not something we recommend, but... Yeah. And that's why we have shallow water blackouts in the pool when you're trying to hyperventilate and then see how far you can swim underwater. So don't do that. Bad idea.
Tim Ferriss had to pull that out of his first edition of 4-Hour Body because people were passing out and having real problems from it.
So, you know, warning, don't do that. So then when it comes to the optimal breathing rate, the speed with which you breathe is one thing. That's breathing frequency. And then your tidal volume, how deep you breathe, is the second factor. If you multiply them together, you get volume, liters per minute, and that's your total ventilation. So what we're looking for is to ventilate the lungs effectively so that you're breathing deeply, you gas exchange everywhere, because there's more blood deep in your lungs than there is at the top. So those deep breaths are better for gas exchange because there's more gas interacting with the blood that's deeper in your lungs. This gravity just pulls it down. So we're looking for nice deep breaths, smooth, slow breathing. So my breathing frequency when I'm sleeping is around 14 to 15. I know that 15 breaths per minute is good. When I'm exercising, it's up to 60 times per minute, depending on what I'm doing and how hard I'm going. So really I don't worry about it in terms of the breathing frequency. I worry about it in terms of clearing CO2, ensuring that you're oxygenated, making sure that you're taking those nice deep breaths as you're speaking to people, pausing every once in a while to take those deep breaths to clean out your lungs and release the tension from your body. And it's amazing when you do that, the effect that it has on other people around you is quite profound. Yeah. And even though it feels like you're taking an eternity to take those one or two or three deep breaths, people just think you're being thoughtful. And then you calm, mm-hmm, down, and everyone else around you calms down as well. It's sort of like when you start a speech, it's okay. Like, you know, I just took a breath there, but like everyone knows you're just like, they're thinking you're just like reading your notes or something. Right. So
I love it that you said that, by the way. Most people, they go on stage and they just freak out and they'll never be quiet. Yeah. You want the crowd's attention. You know, I've been on Tony Robbins' main stage and all, you walk out there and you have that just pregnant pause. The longer you wait, the more they lean forward. And so, counterintuitive. So that's a secret only someone who's been on the stage for a while would know. So,
yeah.
Just a little aside. So keep going. Yeah.
That's funny. That's cool. I'll do that someday if I'm ever on Tony's stage,
you're on big stages anyway. You do a lot of talking. So you learn that, or someone taught it to you. That's cool.
Yeah, it's very, very cool. And I learned it actually being an athlete, because I remember going up and doing races where I was terrified. And those races where I, you know, looked at the cameras or, you know, looked at the stands and stuff like that, and I got too nervous. I mean, the way that you calm yourself down and bring yourself back into the zone is through breathing. It's the easiest, fastest way to control your state. Yeah. And if you can learn to do that, I mean, the direct impact is literally that you control your oxygen and CO2. And so if you're nervous, you hyperventilate, you blow off all your CO2, blood vessels in your brain contract, and you can't think. So when you slow down your breathing, you allow the CO2 to come back up. You take the deep breaths to make sure that oxygen is optimized. Then all of a sudden, you're getting good oxygen levels all through your body. Your CO2 levels are optimized, so your blood vessels are working the way that they're supposed to work. And it's a very, very tightly controlled system in the body. It's one of the most tightly controlled systems that we have. And it's literally just these chemoreceptors that taste your blood, and they keep your blood at that perfect acidity level. And that's how we do it. So pretty interesting. No one's ever asked me that before. So very, very cool.
There are a good number of people in the audience who are going to say, oh, wait, I didn't know I could train that. And if you don't want to go to that, you know, putting things in your nose and measuring what's coming out of your body, which is just, to me, a fascinating little graph on the screen. If you have an Oura Ring, and you guys probably have heard me say this before, but I like to disclose, I am an early advisor and investor in Oura, so I do have a financial incentive for telling you this. They're not paying me to tell you this, but I'm an investor. So there you go. I just believe in the tech. But it will tell you in the morning what your respiratory rate is. So mine is almost always 13.9 breaths a minute. Last night it was 14.2 because I taped my lips shut because I was playing around with nasal breathing versus mouth breathing. There's a whole episode of Bulletproof Radio about that, about the Buteyko method. That apparently is about right. So 14, 15 is where people want to be. But if they're far either lower or higher, how much do they need to worry?
So if you have a very low respiratory rate, I would be worried because that means that your CO2 levels are getting up. That would definitely be a reason to go get a sleep study done and investigate that a little bit more. Similarly, if you're hyperventilating, if your respiratory rate is very high, that is a good indication to me that your body's really stressed because your nervous system is very tightly linked to your breathing and your heart rate. So if your heart rate is high, if your breathing frequency is high, that's an indication to me that your sympathetic nervous system is really activated. And I'd be like, let's just sort of investigate what's going on in life right now. Are you sick? Are you fighting off a bug? Are you super stressed about something? Are you worried about something? And dig into the mind body, because that's probably definitely something to be concerned about as well. I think it's a good indicator for us that it's breathing is a very good indicator for us because it's so tightly linked to our nervous system. If your parasympathetic system is operating well, your breathing will relax. If you're super stressed, your breathing is going to come up. Like, it's tightly linked because it enables us to do what we need to do if in fight or flight. So yeah, definitely something to be concerned about if it's at the extremes there, for sure.
Greg, you're just a wealth of knowledge about recovery, about all these like real biohacking techniques, like the stuff we just talked about that has never in 700 episodes been covered at that level. And your book, though, I think is very accessible. It's nowhere near as geeky as our conversation. I find there's something really special when someone who's a deep expert goes to the trouble to write a book that is very accessible. So you're taking all of the stuff and you're making it teachable and then making it actionable. So even though it's probably one of the roughest times ever to put a book out on the market, and for like, if you're listening to this, you probably never thought of this, but authors, we spend 5 years thinking about a book. We spend 2 years writing a book, and it all comes down to this one day when it goes on the market, and it's like the Olympics for us. Like, it really matters, and it's did the years of effort and the thousands of hours of late nights. Like, is this word the right word? All those things we've done for our readers. To have that come out on a day right in the middle of basically a big pandemic is stressful of all times. But it turns out, I think this might have played into your hands, because a book about, you know, rest, refocus, recharge at a time, and that's what everyone needs the most, it might have been a blessing in disguise. So your book is prime for the time, and it is definitely readable and worth reading. And so, guys, if you want to know about this, it's Dr. Greg Wells. .com, drgregwells.com, and the book is Rest, Refocus, Recharge. If you liked what we talked about, you should read this, because you might find you need more of those things.
Thanks, Dave. I really appreciate it. Yeah, that book launch on the Tuesday after everything in the entire planet went into lockdown was definitely one of the most stressful things I've seen happen. And then you just sort of, you know, you let it go. But then it's interesting, like 2 months in, everyone starts realizing, okay, I can breathe. Oh my gosh, I've got some time. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I've spent time with my family. Like, I'm actually having dinner. And so you're right. I think that it's going to land in a great place. And I really appreciate you having me on the show and giving me a platform to share some of my ideas and talk about physiology, because it's so cool and so fun, and just blessed and very, very grateful for the opportunity. So thanks a lot.
Well, your learning and your commitment to putting it into a usable book, they're laudable, and you earned your way onto the show. Thanks, man.
Right on. Thanks a lot.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey.
The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.